BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. And, for rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is Lise Doucette. She's made it her life's work to bring the stories of people at the sharp end of war, protest and political turmoil to millions as the BBC's chief international correspondent for the past decade and a reporter for almost 40 years. Her reports, most notably from Afghanistan, have earned her global recognition, along with an OBE and an Order of Canada, one of the highest honours her home country can bestow. She was born and raised in a large Catholic family in a small town in eastern Canada, where the values of kindness and community went on to inform her work as a journalist. The human cost of war is what interests her, and when she arrives in a place, she embeds herself in the lives of the local people. In 2002, she went from guest to reporter in a heartbeat when an assassination attempt on her friend, the former Afghan President Hamid Karzai, took place at a family wedding. Of the risks that come with her job, she says, no story is worth dying for, but there are stories worth taking risks for. We have to protect our lives, but we also have to protect our journalism. These stories matter. They have to be told. Lise Doucette, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
What an honour to be here.
So thank you for joining us. I mean, even though, Lise, your work involves reporting on wars and their aftermath, you never describe yourself as a war correspondent. Why not?
I don't want to be defined by war. Everyone I know who's lived in war wants nothing more than to get out of war. And I also don't want to think that my life of travel has been a life of going from one conflict to the other. It's been a life of ups and downs, of light and dark, of humour and happiness. And so I don't want to be defined by that horrible three-letter word, war.
There's another important distinction that you make that perhaps follows that first idea, and that's your thought that international news is no longer foreign. That's important to you. Tell me more about that.
Where is the Syrian story or the Afghan story or the Iraqi story? It's down our street and the families who've moved in. It's in our schools where children of different ancestries all learn together. I always say about these stories of our time that even as in the most complicated and complex story, if you drill down, what are they in essence? In essence, they are about mothers and fathers and streets and neighborhoods and societies and these kind of human stories. They cross borders.
Lise, it's time for your first disc today. What have you chosen and why are you taking it with you?
It's called Habibi Nurulayn, which means in Arabic, my dear, the light of my eye. And it was first released in the mid-90s when I was living in Jerusalem, and it lit up the dance floor. It was just after the signing of an Israeli-Palestinian peace deal, the Oslo Accords in 1993. And while it wasn't perfect, it held out the possibility of peace. And I can still feel that moment of being on the dance floor with Palestinians, with Arabs, and sometimes Israelis too, all coming together with the beauty and the energy of dance. And for a young generation, it was such an exciting time.
Habibi Ya Nur Ulayn by Amru Diyab. Lise Doucette, you've covered the turbulent story of Afghanistan since you first went out there for the BBC in 1988, and you describe the country as a second home where you have very close friends. What are your personal feelings about what's happening there today following the withdrawal of American troops last August?
Painful. Very painful. My pain, of course, is only of consequence to me and my closest friends. And I don't want to say that there aren't Afghans who support the Taliban. This is a very conservative country. But this was not just a leaving of a country, a journey. This was a leaving of, for so many Afghans, a leaving of themselves behind, so much of who they were, what they had worked for, and who they wanted to be. In all of my years of reporting, I've never seen this kind of a situation. And now this is what's happening in Afghanistan. Not a day goes by without a new message arriving in my email, in my whatever social media platform, asking for help to leave the country.
And how do you deal with that?
Not well. It's obviously our job is only as journalists to report, but for so many of us, these aren't just stories. They're part of our lives. The people we report on, report with, have been part of our lives for decades. And so we don't just report these stories. We feel these stories. They're our story as well. And I'm torn because Afghanistan also needs its best and brightest, and some are staying. And they're distributing food to those who would starve if they didn't have people, kind people, to help them. Women who are still taking to the streets. You know, high school students, especially girls and boys, who want to be educated. They want to go to university. They don't want to feel the world has abandoned them. So, you know, I want Afghanistan to survive, but I also want many Afghans near and dear to me to survive as well. It's early days. It's early days. This too shall pass. This too shall pass.
And did watching your friends leave the country change your own views about belonging?
I have come to believe that the word home is one of the most evocative, the most powerful, the most beautiful words in the English language. And I felt it when I came back from months in Afghanistan and I went home in a way that so many of my Afghan friends I knew that possibly they would never go home. And I went to my home, my little town on the Bay de Chaleur, the Chaleur Bay, the Bay of Heat, on the eastern corner of Canada. And I was overwhelmed by the beauty of the landscape, but also just washed in gratitude. I can come home. It didn't matter that there'd been a federal election in Canada. It didn't matter who was in power or not. I had the right to go home.
Let's hear disc number two. What's it going to be and why have you chosen it?
Well, this takes us in a completely different direction. This is called Passionate Kisses. We've heard about the passion of journalism, but there are other passions in life. And this is by Mary Chapin Carpenter, an American singer. And the lyrics really spoke to me. This was released in the 1990s. You know, is it too much to demand? I want a full house and a rock and roll band, pens that won't run out of ink, and cool and quiet and times to think. And women, foreign correspondents, you have choices to make about what matters to you in your life, relationships versus the life that you're, rather nomadic life that you're living. And of course, we all want to think that in some way, we can have it all. Even if we have to redefine what all is, we should try to have what matters to us.
Is it too much to ask? I want a comfortable bed that won't hurt my back. Food to fill me up and warm clothes and all that stuff. Shouldn't I have this? Shouldn't I have this? Shouldn't I have all?
Mary Chapin Carpenter and Passionate Kisses. Lise Doucette, let's go back to the beginning of your own story then. You were born in Bathurst, New Brunswick, which is on the east coast of Canada, a little town there.
Everyone's waiting at Googling now.
They'll find it. What are your memories of the place and of growing up there?
You were proudly connected to your family, but you were also connected to your community. And I grew up with a very strong rooted in a very strong family, six kids, three boys, three girls. And I think this is what has anchored me, not just think, I know this is what has anchored me to allow me to go so far away, is because I have something very strong which keeps me rooted.
Your background, Lise, is a mix of cultures, including Irish and also Acadian on your father's side. Now, the Acadians were French settlers who arrived on the east coast of Canada in the 17th century, and they were actually deported by the British at the height of the Seven Years' War. It was a very violent deportation in which thousands of people died. And as an adult, you researched the history of the Acadians. What did you think when you discovered more about their experience?
Their story was a story of defeat, of sadness, of loss of families, loss of identities. But fast forward to where we are now, and August the 15th is a day of celebration of the Acadian people, because over the centuries, they did come back. They came back to their lands. And the Acadians now have a national day. They have an anthem. They have a flag. And coincidentally, for me, August 15th is also the day that Kabul, Afghanistan, fell to the Taliban. And I say now that tragedies can, over time, be turned into a revival of what was lost. And I've really come to admire what the Acadian people have. I think it's historically, it's a huge, huge achievement, and one that I'm very proud of. I'm not, my family doesn't speak French. You describe us in as an assimilated family, even though some of my aunts and uncles do speak French. But I thought, my name is Lise Doucette. These are both French names. So I've learned French because it's part of who I am.
Audiences often get in touch asking about your accent, Lise, especially at the beginning of your career when you were broadcasting from West Africa. I think you even had to explain it on air. What did that involve?
I would have to go on the program, which at the time took listeners' questions. And so there was, I think the last time I did it, they said, you have an Acadian ancestry. And so I said, yes, it's my Acadian revenge. They didn't give us our land back, but they gave me a job. And I got letters from Acadians from around the world, including someone who said, Lise, you're the Celine Dion of broadcasting. And of course, that's so far-fetched, but it was a nice compliment.
I think it's time for disc number three. Sadly, not Celine. You've got something else for us. What have you chosen? What's your next selection today?
It's from by Lenny Gallant, who is from Prince Edward Island, which is a neighbouring province to my own. And it celebrates that rich heritage of my region, which, of course, is a canvas both of a sometimes painful history, but also a canvas of many, many different cultural influences. The Indigenous people, predominantly Mi'kmaq, the Acadian people, the Celtic influences, Irish and Scottish. My brother, a few years ago, sent this song. He went to a Lenny Gallant concert and he sent it to all of us. And he said, all his siblings, and said, this reminds me of growing up in Bathurst, New Brunswick. So this is Searching for Abergwaid.
Searching for Abergwaid. Searching for Abergwaid. Great am I in your arms. My family free from harm. Searching for Abergwaid. Searching for Abergwaid. Shelter us from the storm, keep us all safe and warm. From wax, the tyrant and armor, we came here to escape the laws.
Lenny Gallant and Searching for Abergwaid. Lise Doucette, your father Clarence was a supervisor at the local paper mill. What are your memories of him?
I think for many men of his generation, that work is what define them. And we were laughing about how when my father had to do his report, like everything had to come to a standstill. Your father's doing his report, you know, stop playing that music, stop standing in the hallway looking at yourself in the mirror. But he was a very loving father, and he did make time to some, you know, family holidays, everyone piling in the back of a light green station wagon and going to see Anne of Green Gables and Prince Edward Island. And then my mother, who really was the rock of the household, I love listening to my mother's stories and how she tells about that, you know, how she had to fight for her education, her mother, Lillian, saving money, borrowing money, but even like hiding a bit of the money she made from selling the butter from the farm so her daughters would get educated as well as her sons. And my mother, after she finished high school, went and worked at a bank. And then She became a mother and she poured her heart and soul into it. And I have to say, I do meet too many women who say that they grew up with their mother's pressures and expectations. And my mother always was, whatever you do is fine. You know, if you, whatever your grades are, that's good enough. You did well.
You loved learning, though, so she didn't have to push you much, did she?
I still remember you have these snapshots in your mind of running down the street to the local corner store run by the family called Asif's. And I didn't know growing up, I only found out decades later, that the family was from Lebanon. You know, we thought they had interesting food and interesting names, but we never knew then, like, where is Lebanon? But I remember, you know, on my tippy toes going up and pointing and getting a little notebook with the crests of all the provinces and territories in Canada. And so that's for me, journalism is also just continuing my education of the world.
Time for disc number four then, Elise. What's your next choice?
This song, Annie's Song, it's my mother's favourite song. And I'd like to think, I can see when I, you know, slam open the door when I come back from school, she's sitting at her sewing machine while her kids are all at school. And in those moments of quiet, I'd like to think that my mother was listening to Annie's Song.
You fill up my senses like night in a forest, like the mountains in springtime, like a walk in the rain, like a storm in the desert, like a sleepy blue ocean.
John Denver and Annie's Song. I want to ask about your first break, Lise, how you took your first steps into journalism. So you finished university in 1982 and you joined a volunteer agency called Canadian Crossroads International. I think it was them that put you on a placement to the Ivory Coast in West Africa, and it was at a small private school. And you said that it was an experience that changed your life being there. In what way?
I started in the, like, a village, living in the village and being part of the village. It was such a good way to start, to be part of the heat and dust of that community.
It also sharpened up the questions that you asked, I think. There was a particular incident, and you know, this is something that you've gone on to do, making an effort to talk to the women in a community. And there was one incident, I think, where you were pounding yams, or the women in the village were pounding yams, and you were asking them questions, and they completely turned around what you were thinking.
One day, you know, in the village, Adzope, what a great name, Adzope, they were pounding and pounding. And I think, oh my God, it takes such a lot of effort. And I said to one of the girls, I said, wouldn't you like to have another kind of life? And she kept pounding the yams and, you know, said, she was in French, so vraiment, c'est une question stupide. What a stupid question. Why would you ask and why would I answer that question? Because I can't have another life. And it was my first brush with being told, like, hey, journalist, you know, try to understand better the society, to understand what it is, how we live and what matters to us and what can change for us. Now, I'd like to think that a lot of people in societies where I visit, that those do want change. But this was my first rude awakening. And come on, get better with your questions.
Let's have some more music, Lise. Number five, what's it going to be?
The Kora. It's played in the Sahel countries of West Africa. And the Sahel is a belt which goes right across the African continent between the deserts of the north and the humid savannas of the south. When I hear the kora, my heart soars. It brings me back to those landscapes. And one of the albums, the LPs I used to listen to when I lived in West Africa, was called Ancient New Strings, with Toumani Diabaté, who's one of the great masters of the kora, with Balakai Sissoko. Both of them are from Mali. And this is called Bilamban.
Thank you.
Bilambam, Tumani Jabate and Balakai Sisoko. Lise Doucette, you worked for the BBC in West Africa for several years, and in 1989 you became the broadcaster's Afghanistan and Pakistan correspondent. You'd taken your first trip to Afghanistan the previous Christmas. What do you remember about it?
I still remember going to the desk of the hotel. And this, of course, was a harsh winter. It was the Cold War when Soviet troops were in Afghanistan. And in this hotel lobby, there was no one else there. It was dimly lit. And I can still see the receptionist on the other side saying, "And how long will you stay?" And I thought, well, is it going to be 6 days, 6 weeks? And I think I said 6 weeks. But of course, here I am.
And was it the story? Was it the country? Was it the people that kept you going back?
It's just in the warp and weft of life that sometimes countries cross our path and our paths become the same.
Did you ever feel at a disadvantage working as a female journalist?
No. In my case, I was working in predominantly Muslim countries at the time, where they do see women as people to be protected. For journalists, it translates into giving you privileges. And of course, sometimes those are privileges you don't want. So you're in a rusty helicopter flying over the Hindu Kush when you're worrying about rockets and Mujahideen in the mountains, and they give you the front seat. There, Lise, you sit in the front. And they go, "Oh, thanks." Or you get the front seat of the bus. People take care of you, and maybe they see you as less threatening. But also, again, it's heart, isn't it, that army chiefs of staff, soldiers, leaders, they pour their heart and soul to you because they see you as aside from their family, often they don't meet women. And there you are to someone to listen. Mm-hmm. And they will, you know, they tell you, share their story.
You became a friend of Hamid Karzai, the former president of Afghanistan. And as I mentioned earlier, you found yourself caught up in an assassination attempt on him at a family wedding in Kandahar in 2002. Two young men approached the president, one to pay his respects, but the other opened fire. How do you remember the incident?
There we were, in that it's so hard now these days to have exclusives, but there we were exclusive. And the BBC security people called up and said, "Lise, were you wearing your flak jacket, body armour?" I said, "Well, no, I was at a wedding. You don't wear a flak jacket to a wedding," which has reminded me that sometimes these risks happen when you least expect them. But it's an interesting example that President Karzai thought that it had been his American bodyguards who saved him. But when we finally flew back to Kabul in the dead of night, he watched the BBC report in the morning and saw that it had actually been an Afghan boy, because that boy who loved the president jumped on the other boy who was firing the gun. The boy was killed, but he stopped the assassination attempt. So he was the hero. So it changed the narrative. Instead of it being Hamid Karzai saved by American bodyguards, although they did play a role, it was Hamid Karzai saved by a brave Afghan boy.
It's time for your next disc, Lise. What's it going to be?
Well, it's called An Elegy for the Arctic, and it's by one of our most brilliant pianist of our time, the Italian pianist and composer Ludovico Einaudi. It was done for Greenpeace. It was filmed in the Arctic, and my sister Andrea introduced me to his music. And you can hear not just the music of a piano, but the music of nature telling us, "Help, help," in our climate crisis of our time. Elegy for the Arctic. Elegy for the Arctic,
Ludovico Einaudi. Lise Doucette, in 2011, you began reporting on the civil war in Syria. Now, you've described it as a war on childhood, and you've made many powerful films featuring children from all sides. Does the story that the children tell cut to the heart of what's happening in a different way?
What was happening time and again, after I'd finished a Syria trip and I'd think back about what was staying with me, what touched me the most, what were the stories of courage, because there was always so many. And more often than not, it was a child who had stood up, spoke out, did something brave. They were able to articulate and tell these stories themselves. I mean, children often feature in our stories as they should, but sometimes they're there because, you know, their expressions, you know, the look of the children, they're so innocent. But I remember it was a change in my approach to journalism. I thought we should tell their stories, but allow them to tell the stories themselves.
And you have said about your role in the past, I don't believe in emotional broadcasting, but I do believe in empathy. Tell me about the distinction.
My feeling is that getting emotional is not really part of our broadcasting. Sometimes it happens and it's part of the story. There was a story that did from Afghanistan where I was at the airport. I was interviewing a journalist and she was in tears. And you could tell my voice, caught in my throat, that, you know, I was also finding it really, really difficult. So I don't believe in emotional, because that means you sort of lost control of your storytelling. But empathy, I absolutely believe in. Although we get so many people emailing or messaging us, oh, you're taking sides, you're this bias, whatever. You know, I believe it's ingrained in all of us that we don't take sides in our reporting. But I feel no hesitation in taking the side of the people, the children in Syria who were targeted, tortured, traumatized. And I do see my job as a journalist to try to feel a little bit about what they are going through. They are no different from you or I. Put ourselves in other people's shoes.
Lise, let's take a break for some music. It's your seventh choice today. What is it and why are you taking it with you to the island?
The next song I want to play is called Here and Now. And it was composed by my brother-in-law, Derek Roach, who's a brilliant musician. He plays many instruments. And the backup vocals are by a Canadian singer named Kathy Evans. And it was composed at my window on the bay where we grew up, Chaleur Bay, Baie de Chaleur. It's a lovely tribute to life.
Early morning, waiting on a sunrise, sipping on a cup of cold tea, hoping to find a way for me to just be. The grass is blowing softly by the window, yellow flowers growing in between. The sky is everywhere, clearer than I've ever.
Here and Now by Derek Roach. Lise Doucette, what about getting back to that place, adjusting to normality once you're home, especially if you've been witness to something or experienced something traumatic? How do you do that?
Things stay with you, but I think it's important to, you know, we have to take care of ourselves too, in the same way we try to take care of other people. And for me, this was after Afghanistan, after months there. I did go home. I did go by the water's edge and spend time with my family, getting up and going to bed with the sound of the waves, the bird song, being there for the first snow, playing cards with my aunts and uncles, to really remind ourselves of the way that life should be and the way that it should be for so many people who live with longing, that it should be that day, one day for them.
Lise, your job is unpredictable, all-consuming. You know, you described it earlier as a nomadic life. Have you had to make sacrifices in your personal life so that you can follow the career that you so love?
I think it's important not to live with regret. Along the way, there have been choices, relationships which didn't work out or proposals which I entertained, but then life took different turns. But the way it's worked out for me is it's worked out in a way that I'm happy with. I live constantly bathed in the sense of gratitude for the life that I live, the friends that I have, the people who love me and I love them in return. I'm constantly reminded of how gratitude is so much a part of who I am.
I'm about to cast you away to our desert island, of course, Lise. What approach will you take to building a life there, I wonder?
Many years ago, I started meditating. I think it's very important to find calm in the midst of the storms and to try to be curious, explore the island, find ways to embrace the day and live it your best day every day.
One more piece of music before you go. What's it going to be?
This is a piece of music, I have to confess, I still can't really listen to it without crying. It's called Dawn. It was composed by a 16-year-old Afghan cellist, Mina Karimi. She's now studying at Interlochen Arts Academy in the United States. The piece was arranged and conducted by her fellow classmate, 20-year-old at the time Afghan pianist Arsan Fahim. He's now studying in Boston. What also intrigued me is that he and Mina decided that this piece, which about women's rights, would be incomplete because the story of women's rights had still not been written in Afghanistan. And of course, they didn't know, none of us knew, even the Taliban didn't know that by the end of the year, in a few months' time, the Taliban would be back in power. The Afghan National Institute of Music, where Arsan and Mina were studying, would be closed down. Musicians would be on the run and women being erased from public life. The Taliban still say they're going to meet the needs of all Afghans, but it's a difficult time.
Lise, you were in Afghanistan last summer. Do you plan to return?
I think I needed a bit of time. But of course, I will go back to Afghanistan because Afghanistan is still part of me.
Dawn, composed by cellist Mina Karimi with Arsan Fahim, performed by Mina with the Afghanistan National Institute of Music's orchestra. So, Lise Doucet, I'm going to send you away to the island. I'm giving you the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare to take with you. You can take one of the books. What will it be?
I think I'm going to take a book to study, keep studying the Persian language. It's such a beautiful, musical language. I love words. And so discovering them in another language is always a delight. So it will keep me very busy and my mind occupied.
You can also have a luxury item. What would you like?
I think I will take what I take now as a luxury item, and I take enough that I share them around with my colleagues and friends, and that's essential oils, small vials of essential oils. They're good for health, good for energy. I wake up in the morning and I use essential oils that I like, the blends that I like to help me wake up to the day. So I think that is a luxury that I'd like to have. And of course, essential oils are from the earth. So who knows, I could maybe even make a few myself.
Finally, Lise, which one track of the eight that you've shared with us today would you save from the waves if you had to?
It's a really difficult choice, but I think I would take Searching for Abigwait by Lenny Gallant because it reminds us of the importance of knowing where we come from to know where we are going and who we are. And it also reminds us of the struggles of people, but also their survival and their celebration.
Lise Doucet, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Lauren, it's been such a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Lise. We'll leave her to get to grips with Persian grammar. Energizing essential oils might be necessary for that. We've cast away many other correspondents, including Anne Leslie, John Simpson, Alex Crawford and Christina Lamb. You can find their episodes in our Desert Island Discs programme archive and through BBC Sounds. The studio manager for today's programme was Sarah Hockley. The assistant producer was Christine Pavlovsky, and the producer was Paula McGinley. Next time, my guest will be the statistician, Professor Sir David Spiegelhalter. I do hope you'll join us.
My name's Jonathan Myerson, and I wrote and directed Nuremberg, the new scripted podcast from BBC Radio 4. My father was a lawyer, and he worked with several of the British prosecutors who'd been at Nuremberg. So I grew up taking this huge trial for granted, the trial of the major Nazi war criminals. With 6 million murdered and 10 million enslaved, how could these men not have faced justice? But it wasn't until I started researching that I discovered it very nearly didn't happen. In the end, verdicts were delivered and sentences were carried out. But was it justice? Or was it vengeance? Subscribe to Nuremberg on BBC Sounds, and you can make up your own mind.